This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Society does not have a good understanding that the assets of nature are the real value of our currencies, even though it's not recognized. What we have now is a currency that is really attendant to the value of oil.
What is the American dollar based on? It was based on the gold standard until 1971, when it transitioned to a floating monetary system. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, however, believes U.S. currency now rests, unofficially, on the price of oil. What will a successful Green New Deal look like if the underlying currency upon which the U.S. economy rests is based on fossil fuels? We speak to James Quilligan, a senior advisor for economic democracy advocates and longtime policy analyst in the international development space. Quilligan explains the history of the commons and monetary policy, points out some of the shortcomings of capitalism, and lays out how to ensure the survival of democracy. He argues that understanding the complexities of our global economic system is the first step in fixing it.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by James Quilligan. He's the Managing Director of Economic Democracy Advocates. James, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I'm really happy to be here.
So first, James, what is Economic Democracy Advocates all about? What's your organization's mission?
We train people to advocate for economic democracy. As the title says, we believe that small units of people can help us to restore democracy, which is we're rapidly losing, as a lot of your listeners know. Because what we've been experiencing is a centralized kind of democracy. We believe in decentralized horizontal democracy where groups can actually do two things. They can create their own democratic protocols to manage their common resources, and they can also talk to elected officials to change the laws of the land. And so I think what, you know, the local democracy groups at regional and local levels are very important to become advocates for democracy, not only through their own initiatives in social action, but also in petitioning their governments to make new laws.
So explain the notion of the commons and then segue, if you will, into how we lost it.
The simple answer is the commons are everything that isn't controlled by government. If you look around on a sort of phenomenological basis, everything you experience in life is part of a commons. The air, the water, the food, your social relationships, your relaxing time activities, your hobbies. It's really all-encompassing. Libraries are a commons, parks, streets, sidewalks. And then the internet is a commons. We think of all those things as public utilities in some ways, especially when they're operated by governments, but they're really more than that. What's happened is we've lost those commons, many of them. They're eroding from our grip. Over the last, let's say, five centuries, since the New World was discovered, 1492 or whenever in that period you want to choose as the turning point, there have been a lot of policies enacted by governments across the world to restrict the use of commons. And so there was an enclosure movement, not only in Great Britain, which is the most famous place, but really everywhere in the world. Boundaries were set up around our commons and excluding the people who used to live on the commons without particular formal laws to govern them. And now by creating formal laws around the commons, some people began to own them or purchase them, and some people began to regulate them. And so a lot of people got marginalized from their own commons and drifted into city environments and labor practices, which really didn't benefit them. So we're at a point right now where the internet is being commercialized, the skies are being commercialized, So we're moving in a direction where we're trying to privatize even the elements of nature. Harvard has copyrighted some of the elements of nature. So it has to do with how government and business have encroached upon our commons and how we need to be able to roll that back and do it in a peaceful way, but do it in a firm way whereby we can generate new laws to govern a sea change for a systematic transformation of the economy and also the way we're being governed.
I can't help but think of people in more rural parts of the country who one would assume would have a lot more open space to run around and play in, but that's often not the case because of the way we enforce private property in rural America. So someplace in the city with lots of parks, there may be more room for children to run around and play in than there would be in the middle of quote-unquote nowhere. Maybe you can kind of flesh out that analogy for me.
You're touching on the key point here, which is that the commons is being privatized to a great extent. And, you know, in the past, we had governments to protect the public interest. And so many of the commons, like national parks or even state parks, were under the watch of government who felt that it was in the public interest to have these as protected areas, as well as areas that were being conserved for future generations for the sake of protecting the natural environment. But that's changing really rapidly. And with population growth, with an increase in non-renewable resources, we're running out of petrol, we're running out of food in some ways. We're running out of, certainly running out of water that's accessible. And clean air is, we're running short of that, not only because of climate change, but the pollution that is attendant to that. There's a real push now to privatize more and more because not only do the people who are privatizing see markets in all this, if only we could go back to the time when things were being regulated by governments, but that day is not here, which is one of the reasons why we think that legislation is still part of the answer. We can protect our local communities, whether we're in regional rural areas or regional dense populated areas like big cities, by recognizing that we all live within a particular bioregion. And if we were to govern that bioregion the way we pretend to govern our political units, each of those districts is supposed to represent the people in a particular area. But what's happened is they may be doing that to some extent, but those districts cut across regional boundaries, and therefore they cut across our bioregions. And the idea that we think is right is that we can begin to unify the rural and urban populations to a greater extent, because in many ways what we have is a lot of the red states are rural and a lot of the blue states are more urban. We can actually begin to heal that if we came into a common framework where we recognize that the most important thing right now is to protect our bioregions. Because if we did that and we governed them effectively, then we can actually become much more self-sufficient. It would have many benefits economically, ecologically, culturally, politically, but we're not even close to doing that yet. So that's one of the areas that economic democracy advocates is trying to bring forward.
And the idea of borders, these hard borders that we take for granted, is a relatively new concept in a lot of ways, isn't it?
You mean in terms of sovereign borders?
Yes.
Yeah, we've had sovereign borders since what was called the Treaty of Westphalia. So sovereignty, modern sovereignty, was created about four centuries ago, I guess. And so all of us have grown up by it. We've been conditioned into it. We believe that national states have hard borders. And the Club of Nations, through the United Nations and through a lot of international activities, have all agreed that, you know, it's very important to keep these borders hard. Now, so what's happened, though, under neoliberalism, the borders became softer in order to facilitate trade across borders and also to develop monetary exchange across borders, to promote tourism, to ease up the issuance of passports so that people could move about more easily. And now there's a lot of pushback against those hard borders now, against the softer borders, which you could associate with globalization. So globalization meant the new movement toward softer borders, and part of the populist nationalism that you see emerging today is insisting on a return to the hard borders, is where we keep out immigrants and we move into areas of bilateral trade rather than multilateral trade. We have much more regulation of our borders as a result.
And how do you see climate change encroaching on that very concept as we have more and more asylum seekers due to disruption to the more vulnerable populations in areas that are exposed to the elements?
Well, climate change is really a catalyst in all of this because it is clearly producing climate refugees who are in the United States. They're coming up from Central America and Mexico. But it's happening everywhere. It's been happening all over Africa. And obviously, very famously, it happened in Syria. And that drove the greater immigration into Europe, which has created, a crisis in Europe and facilitated nationalist populism in Europe in a very forceful way over the last several years. So climate change has a lot to do with this. It was a problem that was festering for a while, but climate change has certainly given the impetus to really weigh the benefits of either sort of a right-wing populism or a more progressive view of how to manage local and regional commons.
About the shape I'm in, I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you, I might not give the answers that you want me to.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to James Quilligan. He's the managing director of Economic Democracy Advocates. So, James, let's turn to monetary policy and the Green New Deal. Why don't we take a step back and explain how Bretton Woods and that 1944 meeting in New Hampshire created, quote-unquote, modern monetary policy, how that changed in the early 70s and where we are now?
The Bretton Woods era from 1944 to 1970-71 was actually an era where there were fixed exchange rates. That means that when nations traded and they exchanged money, they did that on the basis of having money that was valued by fixed rates. After the deregulation of Bretton Woods, the United States took the world off a gold standard, in other words, which meant that we no longer had fixed exchange rates. Now we were with floating exchange rates, which really entered a new period of history for the people who lived in the 1970s, because all of a sudden, massive amounts of credit were available. The idea that that we could borrow infinitely and not have to pay it back became popular. So algorithms began to take over the economy in ways that we, even 5 or 10 years earlier, no one had any idea that could possibly happen, because the world was governed by fixed exchange rates. And fixed exchange rates led to stability because people had to balance their budgets. Nations, they could experience a trade surplus or a trade deficit, but it was always adjusted according to the fixed exchange rates. That all went out the window with floating exchange rates. So that's the big difference now. And we're still in a floating exchange rate era. And the Green New Deal has not really begun to propose anything that's different, because they've embraced the idea of modern monetary theory. And there's a progressive wing that believes that this is the key to the future, and that it could fund a Green New Deal on a massive level by just borrowing from the future. But the fact is that it goes to the heart of what the problem is right now, which is that we don't have, society does not have a good understanding that the assets of nature are the real value of our currencies, even though it's not recognized. What we have now is a currency that is really attendant to the value of oil. And so the value of oil markets has a big influence on the valuation of today's currencies. But there are more factors that go into it. But there is a sense that scarce resources give a certain sense of value that lends our currencies to be able to express value that either is increasing or decreasing based on the increase or decrease of our resources that are available in nature. However, that function has been farmed out to the marketplace rather than the actual monitoring of our ecologies. So we're not measuring sustainability through our currencies. We're actually measuring market value of resources, which are not really resources anymore. They're turned into commodities. They're turned into goods and services for the marketplace. So if you'll look at the balance sheets of central banks, there are a lot of commercial assets on those balance sheets. And that has no place in a balance sheet for a central bank. And yet that's the situation we have. That's the operating system we're working under right now. In the future, it would be really a very smart idea to begin to look at a way of measuring the sustainability of resources in nature, and then begin to use that as the basis of our asset valuation when it comes to the value of currencies. So we're in a crisis situation right now where there are some people calling for a return to fixed interest rates, which would mean either a return to the gold standard or possibly a return, a new dimension, which would be actually looking more along the lines of what I was just talking about, of using ecological value rather than commercial value to underpin our currency value.
So as we got off of the gold standard and shifted to oil as the de facto currency standard, as you suggest, what happens in a Green New Deal scenario where we're getting off of fossil fuels? What would be our monetary policy 10 years from now then?
Well, computers are giving us the algorithms that show that you can roll over debt ad infinitum. I mean, they map it out. But that is clashing with the reality that our resources are in decline. And so you can't just continue to say that on the basis of a computer and a computer program that we can continue to borrow resources from nature, because the fact is that we're running out of resources. So that's impossible to do. We're actually, if we were to finance a Green New Deal like that, we would actually be borrowing further from nature and further degrading nature in order to pay for programs that we think are going to actually improve nature. You know, a really good example of that is the transition from fossil fuels to solar energy. You know, the main reason why we're not being able to do that very rapidly, because it's been on the program for governments for 50 years, but, you know, it's been very slow progress. I mean, there are a lot of innovative solutions out there, but it's not scaling up as quickly as it needs to be. And the main reason for that is it takes fossil fuels to be able to build out the solar energy technologies that we need. And so we're not there yet where solar technologies can actually be created just by the production of solar energy alone. So it's a real dilemma, and we're not anywhere near being able to reverse that conundrum that we're in.
It's like deciding to buy an electric car, but then finding out that car uses a lot of fossil fuels to be built. We have to make these decisions on a micro level, and then we're taking this to an exponentially higher level and looking at it as the future of democracy, essentially. And you call it resource democracy. What is that?
Well, resource democracy essentially means that people have the right to manage their own resources, meaning that, you know, we all of us live somewhere, and we have a sense of place, but that sense of place is often taken away from us because we're not able to access it very carefully or effectively. What I mean is that we're outsourcing our food and water sources to other places. We're actually bringing in food from other states, other places across the country, rather than growing our food locally. Now, of course, there's a movement, relocalization movement, that is trying to reverse that, and it's doing a pretty effective job. Relocalization is very popular right now, but at the same time, what's happening is it's setting up competition between local communities who are trying to relocalize. And so we don't have a regional sense of what regionalization would look like. And there you really get into greater synergy if you're talking about doing the kinds of things on a greater scale that relocalization is looking at. So then we can really begin to talk about resource democracy by managing the resources within our particular bioregion. And now we really have something, because now what we're saying is that society is going to become an ecosystem just like nature is, but we're not there yet. And so part of the dysfunction that we're facing right now is that society is not operating like an ecosystem. It needs to be.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to James Quilligan. He is the managing director of Economic Democracy Advocates. And this week's show is dedicated to the memory of Robert Hunter. So, James, if we go back to what you were talking about with Bretton Woods in 1944 and the transition to the gold standard in 1971, and we see that a lot of international development was spurred on by organizations that were under a capitalist paradigm, like the IMF, the World Bank, and thinking also of FDR and the New Deal. These are good mechanisms for some large-scale transformations to economies. We can probably agree in terms of big projects. You know, the Tennessee Valley Authority is not going to be built by a micro-lending project like Kiva. But the resource democracy we're talking about does empower the individual to be able to be more self-sufficient and not be tied to the vagaries of the IMF or the World Bank. They can actually kind of take debt into their own hands and make their own buying decisions. How does the micro-lending and gig economy future square with some large-scale economic development projects like upgrading an electric grid, for example?
Yeah, the World Bank and the IMF were institutions created after World War II, which actually started out in the public interest. These were ideas that were formed by John Maynard Keynes, and he said that there needs to be institutions that actually extend loans to developing nations at a rate that's better than the rate that commercial banks are extending loans, and offering aid to developing nations. And aid that doesn't have to be paid back, you know, to get the poorer countries back on their feet. So After the 1970s, that all changed when we went to floating exchange rates, because then the IMF and the World Bank did become directly part of the capitalist system. Before that, they were actually part of the progressive movement to ensure that there was a real New Deal for developing countries and the poor of the world. So that leads into the next idea around will a Green New Deal work right now? Why wouldn't it work? Well, those older ideas were about top-down management. You know, they were all about either, you know, even if it's giving loans to the poor of the world on a discounted rate or providing them with aid, it's still a top-down model. It doesn't really regenerate effectively development from the bottom up. So the idea of resource democracy now has to be something that's much more decentralized. It has to be from the bottom up at this point. That's why the problem with the Green New Deal is it's still a top-down model, and it even calls itself a New Deal, which is a very much part of the top-down model of Roosevelt's time, which is why we're never going to go back there, because the time for top-down government largesse is gone. And we really need to, this is one of the reasons why resource democracy has to be initiated from the bottom up, meaning that we create action groups on a local and regional basis to organize our own resources, because nobody else is going to do it for us.
Within the paradigm of sustainability and the Green New Deal and monetary policy, what is the future of democracy in your estimation?
We're losing our democracy. We're losing it on many levels. We're watching it in Washington, D.C., but we're also losing it at local levels, because part of the problem is that people want to have rights, but they don't want to take on responsibilities that allow them to have those rights, which is what the essence of democracy really is. So we're advocating that people really begin to get more engaged politically, to be able to manage their own resources, as well as to change the laws around the management of those resources. Otherwise, we're going to see more of the same thing. Our resources are going to continue to be privatized and regulated by government authorities in the interests of privatization, and people are going to lose their own sovereignty over their own resources. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is if we lose the heritage of democracy at this point in history, it'll probably be the case that we won't be able to recover it for quite some time, because the road ahead is paved with a lot of difficulty. And unless we have democracy to navigate us through that chaos that's going to happen as a result of the clash over resources, then we're going to be in really bad straits.
James Quilligan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.